Chapter 10. What shall we do with the drunken samurai? The teacher of emperors. I spent part of the summer of 1980 on the Greek islands. One of the things I enjoyed most was being ferried around, sometimes in small fishing boats, sometimes in larger vessels, from one island to another. I have vivid memories of taking an overnight boat to Thera, spending the voyage on deck, looking up at the stars in the Mediterranean sky, whilst all the Greeks were down in the stuffy saloon watching Benny Hill on television. One of my journeys took me to the island of Sifnos, where the sea was so rough that the ferry had difficulty berthing. Those of us waiting to embark crowded onto the exit area, whilst the captain, resplendent in yards of gold braid, directed operations, trying to lower the ramp at the front of the boat. There were very few tourists, just one or two backpackers. The crowd consisted mainly of local people, including women with chickens and goats. It was a very tricky operation, stabilizing the ramp. Every now and then it would crash onto the quay, and people would surge forward, hopefully. Then the ship would heave, the captain would speak urgently into his intercom, the ramp would start rising again, and a tide of people, goats and chickens would ebb back into the boat. I remembered my Greek travels when I was thinking about this chapter, because in this third story from the Tiger's Cave, we shall be taking a ferry trip. On board we shall meet the drunken samurai of the title of this chapter. In my very associative mind, a combination of boats and the drunken samurai reminded me of that sea shanty. In Chapter 1, we accompanied Donald Crowhurst in his small boat on the long journey into the South Atlantic and back, until finally he kept an appointment with death. In this last chapter, as we board another boat, it may feel as though we have come full circle, particularly as once again it seems that one of the passengers has an appointment with the man with the scythe. However, whereas Crowhurst was, like the Ancient Mariner, alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea. The ferry includes a Zen master amongst its passengers, so we can have some hope that it will all turn out well. For this story, we will go back roughly 650 years to 14th century Japan. The hero of our story is another Zen master. This one is called Musō Kokushi, or Musō Soseki, and he was born in 1275 and is destined to die in 1351. He would probably not be bothered if you had told him. He is not concerned about the future. His mind is happily wedded to the present moment. Musō is a courteous and cultured person, descended from an aristocratic family. He became a monk at an early age, as it was common practice for noble families to offer a child to become a monk. As a monk, he naturally practiced meditation, but he was also very interested in the arts and literature, and managed to combine a large literary output with a great deal of spiritual teaching. Musō became renowned both as a poet, particularly in a poetic form known as tanka, a kind of short song, and as a great artist in the genre called sumi. Sumi is Japanese painting executed with black Chinese ink and brushes, which can produce very varied effects because the ink can be applied thickly or very lightly. It was quite a while before Musō's main Zen teacher, Koho, acknowledged him as a Zen master. Koho probably thought Musō was spending too much time reading and writing, when Koho would rather have seen him meditating. So, Musō had to spend a long time meditating in seclusion before Koho would authorize him to teach. Having gained that sanction, Musō went on to become the teacher of emperors and shoguns. He had free access to both the imperial court and the shogunate, and was celebrated as much for his painting and writing as for his spiritual qualities. He also produced more than 50 disciples who gained insight into reality. An overloaded ferry. Musō must have been fairly old by the time of this incident, because naturally it takes a while to become teacher to the emperor. As our story begins, he is on a journey, I do not know where he is coming from or going to. If you ask a Zen master that, I suspect you will get a paradoxical answer. Accompanying him is a friend and Zen student of his who also happens to be an expert swordsman. At a certain point in their journey, the two friends come to a river that can be crossed only by a ferry. Ferries are important in myth and legend because very often they take you across from one land to another. Sometimes they take you from the land of the living to the land of the dead, as in Greek myth or D.H. Lawrence's The Ship of Death. In Buddhism, ferries have mythic significance because the other shore in Buddhism is a symbol for the world of freedom, nirvana. At present, we are in samsara, the world of unsatisfactoriness, in which we are subject to old age, sickness, death, being parted from what we like, etc. As we saw in chapter 6, the Buddha once described the Dharma as being like a raft, which takes us from this shore of unsatisfactoriness to that other shore, the world of permanent freedom, peace, and so forth. So for a Buddhist and poet like Musō, the ferry would naturally have an archetypal resonance as he waits to board. The ferry, of course, has a ferryman who is filling his vessel with passengers. Musō climbs aboard, and his friend takes all their baggage and sits on the opposite side of the boat. A 14th century Japanese ferry is unlikely to be very large or perhaps very stable. There is still a crowd of people waiting to board with their luggage. The ferryman makes a charge and naturally tries to cram in as many people as he possibly can until it can hold no more. It is like ferries one can still find nowadays in India, weighed down with as many people as they can possibly carry, and then a few more. Finally, the boatsman decides he really cannot take any more passengers and starts turning people away. He is about to cast off when, barging his way through the crowd, comes a samurai. He comes up to the ferryman, who can smell his breath, which is afire with alcohol. We do not know what time of day this is. If it is early in the morning, as the eponymous sea shanty has it, then this already intoxicated samurai has a bad problem. All we know is that he is drunk and he wants to cross the river now. He is not waiting for the next boat, and he will not be turned away by any fool of a ferryman. What is the ferryman to do? There is only one thing he can do in his position. He is just an ordinary man trying to make a living. He does not have the power to confront the drunken warrior with his sword. So, hardly pausing to think, he allows the samurai on board. Naturally, he is worried about allowing heavily weighted drunk on his already full vessel, but he does what many of us do. We just hope things will turn out all right. We ignore something, telling ourselves it will be okay and we should probably get away with it. And we do get away with it most of the time. The ferryman casts off and the boat starts to cross the river, which is quite broad. The samurai is not only drunk, he is in a bad mood. Maybe he has been drinking out of frustration. Perhaps there is some deep unhappiness in him and he drinks to cover that up. Whatever the reason, he soon starts a quarrel. We are not told the reason for the dispute. Perhaps he is arguing with the ferryman over the fare. He is standing up, swaying about unsteadily and making himself unpleasant. Not only that, the boat is beginning to rock and is very low in the water. If the samurai continues his behaviour, he may capsize it. Musō is sitting there, crammed in among the crowd. Everyone is aware of what is going on, but they are completely quiet, like people on the London Underground when there is an unpleasant incident, all gazing fixedly at the advertisements or at the floor. But Musō is not like that. He is keenly aware of what is going on. He knows very well that actions have consequences, that even people's mental states have consequences. He sees that unless something is done, the boat will capsize. So he speaks up. Musō intervenes in a civil manner. After all, he comes from an aristocratic family and is very cultured. He politely points out to the samurai that if he does not sit down, the boat might sink and they could all drown. The samurai, with his heavy sword, is likely to be the first to reach the bottom of the river. Now, the samurai is drunk, and he does not like being told what to do at the best of times. He certainly is not going to lose face by sitting down because he is asked to do so by some interfering, shaven-headed so-and-so. Not only does he have his sword, he also has an iron war fan in his hand, a very solid implement. The samurai lurches over to where Musō is sitting, crying, "Meddling priest!" and lashes out with his fan. There are many stories of Zen masters who are resourceful and spontaneous in the face of unexpected danger. I remember reading an account by Alan Watts of two Americans who went to visit a Zen master. They had decided beforehand to test him by trying to catch him off guard. One of them had a paper fan, and in the middle of their conversation, he suddenly threw it at the Zen master. The master ducked sharply in mid-sentence, and the fan went straight through the paper screen behind him. However, Zen masters are not magicians. Musō is wedged in among the crowd. He has no alternative but to take the blow. The iron fan hits him on the forehead. Musō does nothing in response. He just sits there with blood trickling into his eyes. Striking out has the effect of releasing something in the samurai. Sometimes when someone is feeling frustrated and angry and trying to pick a quarrel, they are really trying to meet somebody. They are trying to find something solid, to gain some sense of who they are by bumping it up against someone else. Now the samurai has discharged some emotion and is satisfied. He has silenced the impudent priest and put him in his place, so he slumps down in the boat. There is not really space to slump down, but people somehow make room, and he does not cause any more trouble. Musō, of course, is not alone. He has a friend with him. This man, we know, is an expert swordsman. He too is wedged within the crowd and can do nothing to prevent Musō being struck. He is frustrated and very angry that this drunk has struck his friend, who also happens to be the Zen teacher of the emperor and the shogun. So he sits, dwelling darkly on what has happened, waiting for the boat to reach dry land so he can settle the score with the samurai. There is a charged, unnaturally quiet atmosphere on the boat as it makes the long crossing. It finally arrives at the bank of the river and disgorges its passengers onto the shore. The samurai has been half asleep, but as people begin to disembark, he starts up. He then registers from a few words exchanged between them that Musō has a friend with him who is armed. Suddenly aware that there may be repercussions from lashing out with his fan, he looks threateningly at Musō's companion, who gazes coolly back at him. This worries the samurai a little, and he watches appraisingly to see how the man moves as he disembarks. Musō's friend picks up the bags, leaps lightly ashore, deposits the luggage carefully on the ground, checks his sword, and stands in the path of the samurai, who is weaving unsteadily off the ferry. There is going to be a duel. If you have practiced swordsmanship yourself, you can tell an expert swordsman by the way he moves and stands. There is a balance, a centeredness, a lightness and alertness which you can recognize. On the ferry, the drunk had realized that he might be in for a fight. Now, watching Musō's friend take his stand, the samurai is experienced enough to know he is not in for a fight, he is in for a defeat. Who would have thought it? This riverbank is where he is going to meet his end. He has been ferried across to the land of the dead. Probably none of us can tell where we shall breathe our last, but the samurai now knows the time and the place where death will claim him. Miserably defiant, he prepares himself to take his final stand with a hangover. He may tell himself that if he had a clear head he would stand a chance. He would be wrong. He has no chance. He has nothing of Musō's friend's skill, speed, timing, and courage. So he takes his useless stand on the shore, watching his unwavering opponent. They eye one another. The drunk prepares to make the first move. It offers him no hope, but it is better than being cut down in useless defense. The expert watches, taking in his opponent's eyes, posture, and breathing pattern, which all provide telltale signs of the lunging attack that will be effortlessly parried. The drunk will probably not even see the deadly riposte that will follow it. the drunk's knuckles tighten on his sword. Subtle tensing of muscles telegraphs his coming attack. And at that moment, Musso jumps forward with a great cry of, "No!" It is like watching Takuan leap into the tiger's cage, holding nothing back. Musso sees what is happening and intervenes without hesitation. The two protagonists, caught at the last instant, draw back a little, still eyeing each other. Musso turns to his friend, who is waiting for his moment with the drunken samurai, and says, Now is the time to apply our Buddhism. These forms are emptiness. Anger and all the passions are the Bodhi." Then he quietly takes his friend by the shoulder and leads him away. The Samurai's Response. Here our story ends, although one could wish to know much more. It would be interesting to find out how the participants responded after this incident. Did Musso's friend allow himself to be led away out of respect for his teacher? Or did Musso's graphic demonstration of non-retaliation bring home to him that hatred does not cease by hatred, hatred ceases only by love? What about the drunken samurai? He had thought he was going to die on the bank of that river. Did he thank his lucky star that he had survived? Or after a while, did he kid himself that he would have won the duel, that the Zen priest gave his opponent an excuse to back out of the contest he could not win? Or is it possible that as a result of this incident, the samurai changed his life? Did he feel gratitude to Musso for showing compassion to him and saving him from certain death? After all, Musso didn't owe him any favours after that blow with the iron fan. Or did something of the samurai's frustration disappear as a result of having at last met someone who was worthy of respect, someone who actually embodied a higher and more fulfilling way of life? I answer many questions at Buddhist centres. People often ask interesting questions. Occasionally they persist with awkward, aggressive questions. When this happened, I used to wonder, what are they here for? If they really think Buddhism is such a waste of time, and they are so suspicious of it, why do they bother with it? But I have realized over the years that actually such people are often very idealistic. They have a sense of something higher, and they have tried to find it in one situation after another, only to be let down. So they ask challenging questions to test you to see whether you are genuine. Do you really know, or are you just producing fancy ideas? It is possible that the frustrated samurai recognizes that he has at last met someone who could give meaning to his life. Does he later find out that he has struck the teacher of his emperor with his war fan? Does he feel remorse for that? We cannot know. We can only put ourselves into the story imaginatively and see what our drunken samurai does and how he feels. A point in the samurai's favour is that he did what Musso asked. He did stop rocking the boat and sat down quietly. But initially he reacted angrily, as people often do when criticised. If we care deeply about our friends, there will be times when we shall feel the need to challenge or criticise them, criticise something about them which is limiting or unhelpful to them. Even when we do this very carefully and kindly, they do not often reply, "Thank you very much. I hadn't realized I was falling so far short in this area. I am very pleased that you have pointed it out to me." Naturally enough, they react with anger or defensiveness. I am not condoning it. They shouldn't do it. It will only cause them suffering and trouble. But very often this is what human beings do. If we are trying to point out something to someone, and they do react in this way, it really does not help if we then say, "Look, now you are reacting negatively. You are being very sensitive about this." If someone does take it badly that when we point something out to them, we need to try to convince them that we care about them and that that is why we are being critical. We have taken the trouble to challenge them because we feel there is something they are doing which really is not helping them, which is causing, or likely to cause, suffering to themselves or others. If we keep expressing care and concern in this way, then usually, after a while, we can convince our friend that we are not attacking them, but trying to help. Dwelling in the gap. For me, the main message to be drawn from this story is one that underlies all the freedom stories in this book and relates particularly closely to the material on reciprocal relationships in Chapter 4. It is something which I could and may well write a whole book about. Let's leave aside the specific personalities and details of this incident and look at the underlying issues. We shall look at three parts of the story in turn. First, there is the incident on the ferry when Musso speaks up, asking the samurai to be careful not to sink the boat, and the samurai's angry riposte. Why does a samurai respond violently? If we were able to analyse what happened inside him, we should probably find something like the following chain of internal events. The sequence would probably be a little blurred, because the sake, or whatever it is that the samurai has been drinking, is affecting all his functions. First, the Zen master's words would impinge on the samurai's ears, and the message would produce in him painful feelings. These would immediately be followed by concepts, perhaps a little jumbled by drink, amounting to the fact that the priest is telling him what to do in front of a crowd of passengers. As a result, there arises in the samurai a desire, akin to that of a wounded animal, to put an end to the pain the situation is causing him. It may even be that, unconsciously, the samurai responds to the kindness in Musso's tone. The samurai is probably used to people talking to him with fear in their voices, or with command or contempt. To be spoken to with kindness and civility may, strangely enough, provoke in him a deeper pain, the pain of his estrangement from friendship and human warmth. This may be the deeper goad that causes him to lash out. Driven by the desire to put an end to the painful feelings he is experiencing, the samurai, out of control, moves across the boat and deals Musso that blow. If we were to summarize in the simplest way what has happened, we could say that the samurai reacted automatically to a painful stimulus. As so often in life, an action by which one person salves their pain becomes a source of suffering for someone else. Of course, the blow is painful for Musso, but for the moment I am more concerned with Musso's friend. The sight of the iron fan striking his teacher's forehead produces some very painful feelings in him. However, he cannot respond immediately, at least not without risking a fracas that will sink the boat. He has the rest of the journey in which to dwell on how to respond to that painful event. The more he dwells on it, and the more reasons he gives himself for anger at the samurai's action, the stronger his own painful emotions become. Musso is his great friend and teacher to whom he is devoted. It is painful to see someone you love treated so violently. Doubtless he dwells on the injustice of the samurai's action. Then there are issues of status. Musso is a magnificent teacher, a great man, revered by shogun and emperor, and this drunken fool has had the temerity to strike him. Musso's friend may also feel a certain irrational guilt. As well as being a companion to Musso on their journey, he may also have taken upon himself the role of bodyguard. He may reproach himself for not having placed himself in a position to intervene. Powerlessness and frustration add to his pain, and stoke the anger and desire for revenge that he feels. Thus, Musso's companion experiences a toxic brew of painful feelings. Naturally, he wants to put an end to them, which manifests as the desire to fight a duel with the samurai. In fact, to talk of dueling is to dignify what is to happen. Under the warrior code of Japanese society, it may be legitimate to challenge someone in this way. However, the expert with the sword must know that there can be only one outcome to challenging someone who is only a mediocre swordsman and whose reactions are affected by alcohol. Whilst it may be dignified by being called a duel, it is really premeditated murder. So if we analyse what goes on in Musso's companion, we find that in response to a painful stimulus, he dwells on a response, but the response is conditioned by and on the same violent level as the stimulus. Moving forward again, we come to the point in the story when victim and executioner are facing one another on the riverbank. The painful sequence of events is about to reach its inevitable conclusion when Musso quickly intervenes. Musso too has had a painful stimulus to respond to, that blow to the head. But he has developed spiritually to the point where he does not respond automatically to such things. In response to being given a bloody head, he saves the samurai's life. We could look at this scene on the riverbank symbolically. The samurai stands for the painful stimuli in our lives to which we habitually react. Musso's friend represents our habitual reaction conditioned by the stimulus. If this process follows its course, an automatic response will occur, which will then lead to more pain and suffering. We can only break this chain by introducing more awareness into the situation. Musso here stands for the consciousness that we can create in ourselves through Buddhist practice an ethical and compassionate awareness that is not conditioned by a stimuli, but which responds creatively, introducing a new and higher element into the situation. The whole path to freedom relies on creating a gap of awareness between stimulus and response. In the story of Musso and the samurai, the stimuli are painful, but this point also holds good when we are confronted with stimuli that create pleasurable responses within us. Here too, we have to create a gap of awareness so that we are not overwhelmed by pleasurable sensations and react automatically. In that gap, we can find the most creative response, which may be to go along with what the stimulus is spurring us to do or not. On a summer's day, the pleasure of the sunlight streaming through our window may urge us outside, and after creating that gap of awareness, we may follow its promptings to walk in the park. However, there may be other pleasurable stimuli, the banoffee pie, of which we have already had two helpings, or our wife's best friend looking particularly attractive today, which we shall be aware enough to resist. It is no exaggeration to say that our freedom as human beings depends on creating a gap of awareness between feeling and response. As long as we are led by the nose, by pleasurable feeling exciting our craving, and painful feeling stimulating us, stinging us to fear or aggression, we shall never be free. We could have the perfect house, the ideal partner, and a massive fortune, and still have no freedom at all. However, if we could create a strong enough awareness, wise and compassionate, we could be bound hand and foot in solitary confinement, and still have our freedom. Having intervened, Musso says to his friend, now is the time to apply our Buddhism. Creating the gap of awareness between stimulus and response requires us to stay awake, to be alive to what is going on in the present moment. Now, in this very moment, is the time to apply our Buddhism, to follow the path to freedom, by maintaining awareness between each stimulus and our response to it, and not being dictated to by pleasure or pain or any of the other worldly winds. Whatever life brings us, we aim to respond creatively with loving kindness. As we continue doing this, we shall feel our freedom growing, along with a sense of deep equanimity and peace that cannot be shaken by the ups and downs of everyday life. Taking Buddhism to heart. In particular, the time to apply our Buddhism is when things are going badly for us. There are times when it is quite easy to practice the Dharma. We can usually do it when we have the right conditions. At a Buddhist centre or on retreat in the country, we remember to practice the precepts, to be aware, to practice loving kindness. But really, we really need to remember the Dharma when the going gets tough, when times are hard, when we are feeling near the end of our tether, and when life is not being fair. I have worked in several Buddhist centres over the years. One thing that is noticeable is how newer people regularly come along when they are in fairly good states, but disappear for a while when they are going through a difficult patch. Perhaps something goes wrong in their lives, or they are upset about something, and they decide not to come to the centre for a while, or to stop seeing their Buddhist friends. Sometimes they do this because they do not want to trouble their friends or to be a long face around the centre. Very often they do it in order to maintain an image of themselves as happy and okay. So when they are not in those states, they vanish for a couple of weeks or however long it takes until they feel better and then start coming again. It is a great pity when people disappear in this way. Often you make a real breakthrough when you do not feel good, perhaps feel at your worst, and you manage to turn to the Dharma, and in particular to your spiritual friends. When you are feeling low is the time you discover that you can rely on the Dharma and on the Sangha, on other people who are practicing loving kindness, compassion, and so forth. This means we need to make the most of the opportunity when times are not too hard and we have good conditions. Studying the Dharma, meditating, and making deep friendships with like-minded people will give us the momentum we to see us through times when life becomes difficult. Then, when we are faced with one of our own personal tigers, we shall naturally turn to the Dharma and to our spiritual friends. Applying our Buddhism in difficult situations includes remembering that life is not fair. This has been well demonstrated by what has happened to our three Zen masters. Takuan, after all, does not do anything to deserve having to face a Korean tiger. He is sitting in the sunshine, minding his own business, when the shogun says, "Does Zen have anything else to show us?" Bokusen hides a fugitive out of compassion, and as a result, three armed men threaten to decapitate him. Musso just points out in a polite way that the drunken samurai may drown himself and everyone else. All he receives for his concern is meddling priest and a blow on the forehead. Nobody promised you that life would be fair. If they did, they lied. At times when life is being unfair, we can remember the Dharma, reminding ourselves that samsara is unreliable. We can be sure that it will end in tears, one way or another, because it is impermanent and unsatisfactory. Ways of working with raw emotions. These three Zen stories have given us keys to ways in which we can work on our own raw, unrefined feelings and volitions. We saw the swordsman Yagyu facing that tiger, representing those instinctual forces in ourselves, and holding them in check by force of will. Sometimes we may have to do that with our own raw energies. If we do not, they may burst out and hurt somebody. Meditation and Dharma practice tend to increase our energy and put us in deepening contact with our emotions. Learning the art of emotional containment is a vital aspect of spiritual life. At times, one has to hold one's emotions, not giving them expression, but containing them within the crucible of one's awareness until they have been transformed. Takuan demonstrates the final resolution of the conflict between spiritual aspiration and unrefined emotion. He is not afraid of these strong energies. In fact, he is quite at home with them. He speaks their language, spitting on his hand so that the tiger licks it. He meets the tiger on its level and makes friends with it. If we are to succeed on the path to freedom, we need to develop loving kindness for ourselves on a deep level. We have to become a friend of all aspects of ourselves. This does not mean accepting ourselves uncritically, thinking that how we are, warts and all, is okay. We really work to transform ourselves, but we do it on the basis of friendliness and acknowledging what is there, in order to be able to transform it. Takuan tames the tiger by establishing friendly communication with it. In the second story, it is the three samurai who represent the more instinctual forces in ourselves. Bokusan's approach is not to engage energy with these forces on their own level. He continues mindfully dwelling in states of aesthetic appreciation. He does not set up the conditions in which these forces can come into play negatively. What is Musso's approach in the third story? It is summed up by what he says to his friend when he leads him away. First he says, "These forms are emptiness." Musso is reminding his disciple that this samurai is just a process in constant flux, sometimes drunk, sometimes sober, of continuous change on all levels. Life is a flow, a process arising in dependence on conditions. What we are angry with, what we identify as the cause of our problems in life, finally has no inherent existence. This means that, ultimately, there is no samurai to be upset about. Challenging him to a duel is, on the deepest level, a dialogue in a dream, which, incidentally, is the name of one of Musso's most famous works. Musso's approach may be hard for us to use. We shall need to have quite a strong grasp on the Buddhist view of reality before we can employ it successfully in confronting our own negative states. It is important to understand it, however, and when we have travelled some way down the path to freedom, we shall find that this approach is the most effective antidote to any trouble or suffering. Not only does Musso say that all forms are emptiness, he also says anger and all the passions are the Bodhi. Bodhi means illumination. It is a word for enlightenment. This is quite a strange idea, that anger and all the passions are illumination, enlightenment. It does not mean that everything is one, that we are all enlightened anyway, so it doesn't matter what we do. Enlightenment is a state of permanent satisfaction, happiness and bliss, and when we allow ourselves to become furiously angry with someone, or very resentful, we do not feel very blissful. There are three ways in which we can look at what Musso is saying here. The first is that he could be pointing out to his friend that the whole of life, including this drunken bully, is a manifestation of reality. The drunken samurai is a perfect example of the way in which everything arises in dependence upon conditions. Another, perhaps more useful way of looking at it, is that all the passions are expressions of energy. Musso's friend is very angry with the samurai, and as a result is in a highly charged state. Having large amounts of energy is in itself a good thing. The problem is to prevent it being expressed destructively, and to find channels for it that take us towards freedom. The challenge usually is to unhook the energy from the object with which it has become caught up. Let's imagine that Musso leads his friend away from the riverbank and they find a quiet place in which to sit and meditate. Musso's friend's blood is still boiling, but he follows his teacher's injunction. He works to let go of the incident of the samurai. Having unhooked his feelings from their object, he now experiences the anger simply as very strong waves of energy flowing through his body. This unhooking of the energy can be used whenever we are caught up in high energy negative states, whether of anger, craving, or jealousy. At first, it can take a considerable effort of will to let drop our intense involvement with the object. But if we manage to do so, and to own the energy, we can find ourselves in some very positive and liberated states indeed. With deeper practice, we can even take the process a stage further. As well as unhooking from the object, we can also unhook from the subject, letting go of the idea that I am experiencing the energy. Finally, we are left with experiences of pure energy. At this stage, we shall be able to feel for ourselves how the passions, unhooked in this way, can be expressions of enlightenment. A third possible interpretation of Musso's injunction is that all our feelings, including anger, hurt, greed, jealousy, fear, and so on, have no absolute validity. Our mental states quite often present themselves to us as if they are absolute. If we are feeling depressed, say, it is hard for us to remember feeling any other way. We also tend to think that our view of life from that mental state is absolute. This is how the world is. We do not realize that we are filtering our experience through our current mood and view of life, both of which are partial and changing. In any strong negative state, it is very hard to conceive of things being different. One of the ways in which one can recognize negative states is by their inflexibility. But what Musso is saying is that these feelings are not absolute. They are the play of our consciousness. If we meditate deeply, if we practice the precepts and gain insight into reality, we shall understand the true nature of our minds, and see all these different feelings as they really are, nothing more than manifestations of the ever-changing flow of the conditioned mind, then they will no longer dominate our lives. Putting it at its simplest, Musso is reminding his friend of the Dharma, urging him to remember that his present experience, his present feelings, although they feel very absolute and imperative, he is locked into dealing with that drunken samurai who hit his friend and teacher, are impermanent. All mundane things are unsatisfactory, insubstantial, ungraspable, and they will pass. Bearing this in mind, he need not feel compelled to act on them. Thus we can work on our feelings by recollecting the nature of phenomena and applying that understanding to the situation in which we find ourselves. This approach can give us a broader and lighter perspective, sometimes even a glimpse of another dimension, which enables us to become free from being trapped in our limited views. Freedom for others. It is appropriate that this book about freedom should end with the story of compassion and forgiveness. Zen, being a Mahayana school, Musso has based his life on the Bodhisattva ideal. He is committed to gaining the total freedom of enlightenment, not for his own sake, but out of the wish to help all living beings. This is how it has to be, for it is not possible to gain complete freedom for yourself alone. As long as we are still emotionally clenched around an idea of a fixed self which will become free, that limited notion will give us, at best, a limited freedom. It is only when we see through our belief that we are a fixed, inherently existing I, that we shall open our hearts finally and forever to all life. It is that radical reorientation of our entire being which is the key to total freedom. Whilst it may take us many years of work to arrive at that radical reorientation, it is good if, from the beginning, we work with the aim of becoming free in order to help others. After all, the world needs whatever crumbs of freedom we can feed it. We have only to look around us to see that there are many equivalents of the drunken samurai around today. There are plenty of people who have no notion there could be a path to freedom. There are more than enough people trapped in painful mental states who take them as absolute as how life is. These reflections can motivate us to put more energy into our own efforts to become freer, to work with our own minds, to create a gap of awareness in which we make new, creative choices. The whole world thirsts for freedom. Any step we can take along the path to liberation will be of benefit not just to ourselves alone. It will be a gift to the world.